It's a lesson. You must make a lot of noise, not arrogant noise, but just explain. Obviously, I'm the best person for it. Don't be shy and retiring and Asian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the New Voices Podcast. I'm Joanna Chu. And today, our guest is the legendary writer, Jan Wong. She's also my friend and one of the very first China journalists who supported me in my career. We actually met when I was, just, 22 years old for the first time in Vancouver before I moved to Hong Kong for my first journalism internship in Asia. So Jan is also our featured podcast guest in partnership with Canada's largest independent book publisher, House of Anansi, for Asian Heritage Month. So New Voices and House of Anansi is working together to spotlight these Asian authors, including Jan and others. So you can learn more about this campaign and our book recommendations on houseofanansi.com. That's houseofanansi.com. And it's exciting that some of the proceeds of book sales on Anansi's website will be donated to New Voices. So check out some book recommendations, and Jan Wong's episode partly will be promoted and published on Anansi's platforms as well. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you for having me here. I remember our first meeting. You had just graduated from Columbia. Yeah, that was great.
I was probably so keen and bright-eyed about my future ahead of me.
Well, you still are. You haven't changed a bit.
Oh, okay. Maybe a bit more jaded, but you know, not too bad.
Not bad.
So yeah, it's very special because someone just wrote in a review of my book in French that I'm maybe Jan Wong 2.0, and I was so flattered.
I'm flattered.
I guess there's not many Canadian journalists who have spent time in China and has written about China. A little bit about you from your website. You're a first generation Canadian. So your parents or grandparents actually started
grandparents.
So some of the first Chinese restaurants in Canada.
Oh, so that's my father. Yeah. Oh, okay. But my grandparents are the ones who immigrated here in 1881.
Wow. And that was before some of the Chinese head tax exclusion.
Yeah,
tax.
It was their fault. They came and everybody said, hey, let's have a head tax. Yeah, yeah. No, my dad was, we think the first, of course, it's always dangerous in journalism, we know that, to claim to be the first, but we think he was the first to open a Chinese restaurant outside of Montreal Chinatown. And in those years, I think the Chinese community in Montreal might have been the biggest. I'm not sure. Maybe Vancouver was the biggest, but it was definitely bigger than Toronto.
I think things have shifted since then. I was just in Montreal.
Yeah, big shift. Yeah.
But, you know, growing up, you actually didn't speak Chinese.
Correct.
And in the summer of 1972, you were majoring in Asian studies at McGill University. And that's when you traveled alone for the first time to the People's Republic of China. And you talked your way into a spot at Peking University, becoming first of two Westerners to study in China during the Cultural Revolution. That's how I first got to know your work, because your book, your amazing memoir, Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now, was actually required reading in my first year China course.
Oh. That's great. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, it was such a vivid first-person account of the Cultural Revolution from someone who's Chinese-Canadian and who learned Mandarin, being forced suddenly in this unusual situation. Before we go on about the rest of your career, can you tell us a bit about those first years and what your memoir covers?
Right. And I also want to say it's directly linked with my subsequent career in journalism. Because I remember at university not knowing what I could major in. And as I was a third generation, and my father had studied engineering, my mother had been a nurse, that those were the typical, you know, science, tech-based roads for Canadian Chinese to go into. But I was hopeless in things like science and math, and I kept worrying about, what am I going to do? And so gradually I thought, well, I like writing, I like spelling, I like talking to people, I'm super nosy. Okay, so maybe journalism, but how can I compete? as someone who looked like me, there was no one as a role model. And I thought, maybe I should try to become an Asia specialist, a China specialist. So maybe I need to learn Chinese. So that was like this really vague career goal I had. And in 1972, I thought, it wasn't even my idea. I had a white classmate at McGill who said, why don't we go to China on our summer vacation? I mean, I didn't have the imagination to even think that. And I said, okay. And we both applied. And because she's white, they turned her down. And that was my first experience with this kind of really weird apartheid attitude in China. Like, overseas Chinese are different from other foreign citizens. And so I had taken one course at McGill in Mandarin, and I thought I did okay. I probably got a good mark, but when I got to China, no one could understand anything I said. And so I, cause it's a tonal language, as we all know. So I remember agitating, can I learn Chinese? And because it was a cultural revolution, they told me with a completely straight face, and it was true, that no one can teach you Chinese in China. No one's teaching Chinese.
Because everyone knew Chinese, I guess.
Yeah, and then nobody was doing anything for money. So, But then one day they came to me and just said, okay, don't go anywhere. Stay in your hotel. You can stay and study here. And I said, where, what, when, nothing. They said, if you wanted to study, just sit there. And I sat in the hotel for a month. And then it was all very mysterious. But that's sort of like journalism, right? You have to say yes. You don't know where this is going to end up. So it ended up with, I ended up at Peking University.
Wow. And so the Cultural Revolution, I guess you arrived in China in 1972. So it was already underway.
The middle. It was the middle. The violence had mostly ended. Okay. So I didn't see any violence. What I saw was the attitude of the people, uniformity. A lot of people were frightened, but I didn't understand that. I didn't know enough to understand that when people were telling me things, they were just saying it. They didn't mean it. Mm-hmm. But I had no comparison. I'm coming out of Montreal, and I thought when you ask a question and people give you an answer, they generally mean it. I didn't have any context. It's so funny because at McGill, I had taken Chinese history, but we never made it to the 20th century. You know, I hadn't studied this yet. So I was very naive. And that's what I write about in Red China Blues. I write about, I was a lefty because everybody was a lefty. I mean, there were everybody was a lefty at university in the 70s. Yeah. We all were going on strike and supporting the janitors. And, you know, so it was, I came to China from that point of view, very supportive of the revolution, very supportive of Maoism, knowing nothing, being super naive and really ignorant.
Yeah. So what were you mostly doing? You were like digging ditches, like you were harvesting wheat. You were shoulder to shoulder with, you know, Chinese students who were, you know.
Yes. So if you want to blend the first stint and the second stint, which were only a year apart, I had come back for my final year at McGill. Yes. So I had Chinese language lessons. And then by then, after a year, I was pretty fluent and I could be in a normal Chinese university class only because their educational level was so low. My classmates in the Chinese history department at Peking University were not well educated because their high school educations had been truncated. So we had our lectures, but we also, it was still the Cultural Revolution. So we had things like they closed our university and we marched down to the farm and we built our own homes with brick and mortar. We planted trees. We harvested rice. We planted rice and we harvested it. So, we did a lot of agricultural work. And I also worked in factories. Wow. It was like really interesting as a journalist, for a future journalist. It was not very good if you wanted a university education.
Yeah. And at the time, you're already thinking of potentially becoming a journalist.
Right. Yeah. So I was keeping a journal. I was trying to write, you know, stumbling around trying to figure out how to write. But that was my goal.
Yeah. And so few, you know, international people were in China.
Yeah.
Let alone kind of living a life pretty close to mm-hmm. what ordinary people because of this unique position you had of being Chinese Canadian.
Yeah, there was almost no one with this experience. And for example, later when I finished Peking University and the first U.S. correspondents were arriving in Beijing, I think there were only four mm-hmm. of them to start with. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe I could get a job as a news assistant with them. Mm-hmm. And I wrote little notes and you put it in the mail and then mm-hmm. I think they have to write you back because I didn't have a phone. And they all wanted to hire me, all except the Wall Street Journal, because that guy, mm-hmm. he didn't want to. He already spoke good Chinese and he wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. But all the others, like Washington yeah. Post, New York Times, Associated Press.
Yeah. So they were starting the first bureau.
Yeah. And they wanted somebody who had lived the Chinese mm-hmm. experience to be a news assistant. So yeah. it was really – so I was right. If you just go and do this stuff, maybe you have a chance.
Yeah. And so in 1979, you did become the first ever news assistant for the New York Times in Beijing.
Right.
And how long did you do that?
I did it a little under a year. And because I decided I would leave China and I had to figure out a way to make myself look less insane. If you looked at my resume, I looked pretty insane. And I thought, okay, so maybe if I go to journalism school, I'll kind mm-hmm. of like normalize my weird resume. And I remember my boss said, no, you don't need to go to journalism school. I'll show you everything. Mm-hmm. So I asked the other correspondents in Beijing, what should I do? Because Columbia's mm-hmm. accepted me. But Fox said, he'll teach me everything. They said, go to Columbia. mm-hmm. And so I went, and you know, mm-hmm. it helps being first, because I know it's been very hard for other people. You have to pay a yeah. ton of tuition. I got mm-hmm. a full scholarship because I said my resume was insane, and they looked at this weird application, and I got in, and you know, I was really lucky because yeah. I was so weird. I'm not so weird anymore.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people have kind of followed in your footsteps.
Yeah, now it's okay. It's a good idea. But when I did it, it was like, what are you doing there?
Yeah, you're there before the foreign correspondents.
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Just before they arrived in China, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Just to get a sense, what was it like that year when the foreign bureaus were just starting up in China? How were they going about their work in China? Were there a lot of restrictions? Because I know they were confined to having offices and living in diplomatic compounds, but
yeah. They didn't even have diplomatic compound apartments. They lived mm-hmm. in hotel rooms.
Oh yeah.
They lived in the Peking Hotel. Mm-hmm. So the Times had two rooms. One was the bedroom for Fox Butterfield, and the other one was the office that I shared with the driver and the interpreter. Mm-hmm. So it was like a regular twin bed, hotel room. And we worked from there. It was hard because Chinese were not used to foreign reporters. So for them, it was hard because they were white. Mm-hmm. And several of them spoke pretty good Chinese. And they would go up and ask people something, and people would freeze. Mm-hmm. A, they would freeze because a foreigner was talking to them, but B, they didn't think they could understand what the foreigner was yeah. saying, even though the foreigner was. So I remember once it was a line for something, and I was out with my boss, and he went over to them and said in pretty good Mandarin, you know, mm-hmm. why are you waiting in line? Mm-hmm. And they just didn't understand what he said. So I walked over and said, why are you waiting in line? And they were trying to buy TV sets.
Yeah.
So that was a barrier. And the second barrier was the state was really hyper worried about foreign journalists. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know that American reporters did get sources into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was bad.
Yeah. So even then, you know, opening up to the West wasn't necessarily an open embrace. There was still a lot of nervousness about what Chinese people could be saying to foreigners, which, you know, we still see to this day.
And it was an even tighter society, like much less freedom, very little freedom of movement. You couldn't even leave the very limited city limits of Beijing. Mm-hmm. They had literal guards at the roads and signs up saying no foreigners mm-hmm. past yeah. this point.
Yeah, when you saw signs like that, did you think that it applied to you or that you could just kind of breeze through?
Both. I knew it applied to me and I went right through it.
Yeah.
I just like, I'm on a bike, you know. No, it's ridiculous. So, yes, I would go right through it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's early journalism training. If they say don't come in, you go in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think even when I was working as a foreign correspondent, looking Chinese also had quite a few advantages because...
Oh, it's great.
You're less noticeable and people are generally more open to talking, even if I'm speaking
exactly
badly with an accent, you know.
Oh, it's one of the first rules of journalism is you want to reduce the gap between you and your subject, interview subject. So if you're a banking reporter, you should wear a suit mm-hmm. to go and interview the banker. And if you're going to interview people in a shelter, you should dress in comfortable clothes like your jeans.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to always, for comfort level and for intimacy. So, of course, for China, we had this built-in advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very awkward for foreign journalists.
Yeah. In places like Beijing, Shanghai right now, they're pretty used to foreigners speaking Chinese. It's almost an expectation. It's like, oh, you're here for how many years and you still don't speak Chinese?
Yeah.
So things have changed in that way. Right. But just moving on, because your career has been so varied and you've accomplished so much and written so many books. So you had a year at Columbia Journalism School, graduated. You got a job pretty quickly as a business reporter, starting at Gazette in Montreal, later Boston Globe, Wall Street Journal, and then Globe and Mail. And eventually you made your way back to China. So can you tell us how you kind of maneuvered to become a correspondent in the Globe and Mail foreign office?
Mm-hmm. So when I was at Columbia, I think it's kind of my rule is always scare yourself, mm-hmm. always get your money's worth, always try to do something you don't know what you're doing. So I looked at all the options mm-hmm. and I thought, well, I don't know anything about business reporting. So that's what I specialized in, not realizing that's where the jobs were when mm-hmm. I graduated. And it turns out business is really fascinating. Because it reminded me of the Communist Party. Big corporations are organized along the same lines as a Communist Party. And the CEO is like, you know, Chairman Mao. Their word is absolute. They're surrounded by sycophants and they don't want to hear bad news and everything's a secret. So I immediately saw real parallels with China. But I also thought it's really important to do some nuts and bolts reporting and to understand the economy and business. And so I did it. But I kept wanting to go to China. And so I was at the Wall Street Journal. I was getting very discouraged because I got a new bureau chief, not the person who hired me, and we didn't get along. So that was the first blow. And the second blow was the Wall Street Journal closed its Beijing bureau. And no one believes me, but they closed it that year. I could think it was the late 80s. And they said, there's no news in Beijing. I kid you not. So I was like, oh my God, why am I even at the Wall Street Journal? Mm-hmm. I don't even like my boss. And they closed the bureau. So I looked around and there's the Globe and Mail sitting there,
mm-hmm.
which was the first Western newspaper to open a bureau.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, let me apply. Mm-hmm. And the editor-in-chief, Norman Webster, happened to be one of the former bureau chiefs. So mm-hmm. It was just so lucky for me. They saw me apply and they said, yes. I got there and within a year, I remember I said, when I went around, you know, during my job interview, I talked to the foreign editor and I said, well, my real goal is Beijing. And he laughed in my face. And he said, get in line. So I did. And I got the next opening, which was less than a year later. So that's how I did it. So the lesson is you got to maneuver. You got to move around.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not happy somewhere, look around.
Yeah, be strategic.
Yeah, find a place, right? I think I told you that.
Yeah, you've given me like lots of good advice over the years.
Yeah, you didn't like some place you were at. And I said, you know, you can just jump.
Yeah.
And you jumped and you landed on your feet, and it was really a great move. So that's how I got to the Globe and Mail Beijing Bureau.
Did you have to make a case that you should be the one sent, even though you were a relatively recent hire, just because of things like your experience in China and ability to blend in?
So this is the other lesson. At the time I was applying, by chance, two other new reporters at the Globe both spoke Mandarin, and they both wanted the Beijing Bureau. After years of nobody speaking Mandarin, suddenly mm-hmm. there were three of us. So this is the lesson. If you want something, you have to go mm-hmm. all out for it. And you can't hide your ambition, and you can't hide your feelings. So this is what I did, two things. I had to be a superstar mm-hmm. in the business section. How do you do that? Doesn't matter what your story is, you're going to try your best to write that story mm-hmm. onto page one. And I'm stuck in the business section, right? You're going to get on page one. You're going to figure it out. That's the first lesson, because mm-hmm. you've got to shine. Second lesson is you've got to be completely humble and don't take anything for granted. And you've got to write your letter of application mm-hmm. and make your case and say, and you got to formally apply. You don't assume that I've said mm-hmm. it. They know I want it. You have to formally apply mm-hmm. and remind them why yeah. you should get it. Mm-hmm. And so I got it. So I was very lucky, but it didn't just happen. It's a lesson. You must mm-hmm. make a lot of noise, not arrogant noise, but just explain. Obviously, I'm the best person for it. Don't be shy and retiring an Asian.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like people have been confronted with an assertive and confident Asian woman. Sometimes I think that helps because you're bucking the stereotype and people are
yeah.
kind of standing up and paying attention a little bit
more. Be confident, be assertive, and make it known that you're going for this.
Mm-hmm. And so once you were there, can you give us a few highlights of your reporting as bureau chief in Beijing for the Globe? And maybe like when did you end up writing your first book? Was it after you were already back from China?
So when I got there, I was so excited. It was just like, it was my career dream. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, everything is a story in China. Mm-hmm. You know, I think here when you work as a journalist, sometimes you're going like, I don't have a story.
Yeah.
In China, it's just coming out of, oozing out of your pores. Mm-hmm. There's so many stories.
Yeah.
Partly because the society is changing so rapidly. Partly because it's the biggest country in the world. So no matter what, you've got a great story because all the numbers mm-hmm. are going to help you write your way.
Yeah.
And partly because it was a time of a big upheaval in China. So, of course, the big story was the Tiananmen pro-democracy movement and the huge crackdown. So that was, you know, the highlight.
Yeah. And were you a witness?
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I was posted there in the summer of 88. First of all, you know, the dissidents were starting in January. It was starting to build in January 1989, and then it kept building all this crackdown on dissidents. And so in the spring of 1989, it went on for weeks. And it went on so long that a bunch of reporters actually got tired and left just before the June 4th massacre. And I remember thinking, I'm tired too. I think I should go. I would really like to rest. Mm-hmm. And I remember my husband said to me, it's not over till it's over. And then his company that he worked for said, you got to get out. Like, it was an American software company. And they said, we'll give you first class tickets anywhere in the world. And it's like, oh, no one's ever given me first class tickets. And I said to Norman, what do you think? Should we go to Paris? And he said, well, if I was a housewife, I would. But if I was a reporter, you couldn't pry me out of here. And it's like, oh, yeah, you're right. I'm a reporter. So it went on and on, and we were all traumatized and exhausted. And we had PTSD with not even knowing what the word was mm-hmm. because we had witnessed it all. We had witnessed this whole thing.
Yeah.
Most reporters witnessed it. If you were down at Tiananmen Square, and I happened to have rented a hotel room, with a couple of other reporters just as a vantage post, not knowing this would happen, just a place to go to the bathroom, to make phone calls, to charge your laptop. So we saw it all. It was terrible. Mm-hmm. It was terrible, but at the same time, as a journalist, you go, yeah. Oh, my God, I usually you don't see things. Most of the time, journalists rush there an hour after it happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not while it's happening.
And we interview witnesses. And this time, we were the witnesses. That was the big difference with Tiananmen. Like, I witnessed it. I witnessed tank men.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I didn't know. Were you in the hotel, like by the windows?
Yeah, I was still in the hotel, and I was, I think I was writing, mm-hmm. and my husband had come to the hotel with me, and he stayed because of the massacre, mm-hmm. and he said, you better get out here. He was on the balcony, mm-hmm. and I ran out, and I saw it, and I was like, oh my God, how am I going to talk about mm-hmm. this? How can I write this so it's so vivid? Yeah. And I phoned my editor, and she said, it's okay, we have the footage.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah, because I didn't know who else was in the Peking Hotel, right?
And I guess at that time, you didn't have a camera with you.
No, we didn't have video, and I wasn't taking pictures because as part of the crackdown, mm-hmm. in the lead up, they already told reporters we were not allowed to take pictures, and I didn't want to get expelled for taking photos. My real job was print, and so I wasn't taking pictures. But luckily, you know, the AP and all other wonderful photographers were there, and mm-hmm. they got their film out. That was an adventure. They got their film out, but we were all isolated. We didn't know who was in the hotel, and we didn't want to wander around. Because they were going around kicking us out. The police were going door to door in every hotel room mm-hmm. and kicking all the journalists out. Mm-hmm. So what I did, it sounds ridiculous, I hung a do not disturb sign on my doorknob.
Yeah.
They didn't disturb me. And I made I'm serious. And I made my husband go down and re-register. Mm-hmm. He had a different visa. He had a businessman's visa. So he registered. Yeah. I put the do not disturb sign. I think I was the last reporter still in the hotel. And they were shutting down the hotel. Mm-hmm. They were turning off the lights and the elevators. And I just felt I'll stay as long as I can. And then after a while, I thought, okay, now mm-hmm. I think I forget how many days, if 3 or 4 days I stayed. And then it seemed stupid. So then I went back to my office. And by then, the Chinese police had stolen my car. I had parked on a side street because I didn't want them to know I was in the hotel. So I parked on – yeah, they stole my car.
Right. Did you ever get it back?
Oh, yeah. I got it back a year later. We caught them red-handed. It was another great story.
You have so many great stories. So when did you end up writing your first book, and how did you kind of shift into – both being like a full-time journalist and then taking little breaks or working on your books on the side?
After Tiananmen, a lot of the resident correspondents in Beijing had book contracts. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them left right away. Everybody was racing to come out with the first book mm-hmm. on Tiananmen because the first book usually sells the most, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember being approached. I can't even remember who wanted me to write. And I remember thinking, I don't want to leave. I can't leave right now because the whole story of what happens after Tiananmen is super important. I'm not going to leave. So I did not feel tempted at all to write. And then when the Globe and Mail said, okay, 6 years is enough, it's time to come back.
Yeah.
That's when I contacted, or maybe they contacted me, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. That's when I said, okay, now I'm going to ask for a book leave. Now I'm going to write the book. Mm-hmm. Because my book was not just about Tiananmen. The book publisher, they didn't know my history. They didn't know I had gone to China in 1972 as a lefty, mm-hmm. very naive university student. And I didn't tell them. I didn't want to tell anybody until after I had figured out what my story is. Mm-hmm. So it was perfect. So I came back. I had a publisher, and I asked for a year's leave from the mm-hmm. Globe. I think it's impossible to write when you're a daily reporter.
Yeah, I did it.
I know. And you don't even look like you age. I mean, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah. it was even harder than people thought. So anyways, but it was a pandemic and I was stuck inside.
Oh,
I don't think I
would
have done it.
Oh, no, it's very hard to write a book, especially to switch from daily journalism to long form narrative. That's very hard.
Yeah, that was an adjustment, but you've continued to do that. And after Red China Blues, which was a huge hit, you published Lunch with Jian Wang based on your very popular celebrity interviews, which were very quirky. People can get a sense just from listening to you what your interviews are like with celebrities. And then Beijing Confidential, which kind of is sort of like a sequel to Red China Blues.
Right.
A Tale of Comrades Lost and Found. There's so much. I mean, I think we can like take a year of your life and make a whole podcast episode about it. But I will just direct you to read her books, and we'll have a full list in our show notes. So Jen, we're actually very excited to have our first advertiser supporting the New Voices podcast. Have you heard of greatfire.org?
No, I've never heard of them.
Well, they're an anonymous organization actually based in China that has been developing and launching projects since 2011 to bring more transparency to online censorship in China. And their free online tools have been very helpful to journalists and researchers, including myself over the years, as well to anyone who is curious about what online discussions in China are actually like before they are censored. We're highlighting two other projects on the podcast, starting today with freewechat.com. So free, that's F-R-E-E, wechat.com, republishes information that has been censored on public-facing WeChat posts. So as you know, WeChat is the biggest social platform in China, yet censorship is rampant, very sophisticated. Most times users are not even aware of information that is missing. So free WeChat helps to fill in the blanks. And unlike Weibo, which is in the China's version of Twitter, users in WeChat usually write pretty lengthy and detailed posts, basically sometimes news articles, blog posts, things like that, like kind of personal essays, which can make for some pretty detailed reading. So free WeChat allows users to archive WeChat posts before they get censored if they, you know, want to purposefully make their content available on this service. And since this service, like many websites, are blocked in China, you can access it through a safe alternative link that is custom for New Voices at 91115.net. So just numbers.net. So it's 911, the, you know, emergency line, and then another 15.net, five numbers. This custom link helps us track how many of our listeners are being directed to free WeChat and could help us secure more advertising in the future. So even if the Great Firewall isn't an issue for you, please check out free WeChat through 91115.net, and that'd be a great help to us. Please note that Great Fire tries its best to filter harmful, violent, pornographic content from its services, but it might not catch everything. So please be aware when you're browsing. Okay, let's get back to the show. So we're going to shift a bit because you continue to be just a keen observer of what's happening between China and what, you know, the West and international stories to do with China. You recently retired as a journalism professor at St. Thomas University in Fredericton. So I'm really keen on getting your thoughts on some of the current events happening related to China and Canada and the US. So kind of first issue, the FBI arrested two alleged Chinese agents and charged dozens more with working inside the U.S. to silence dissidents, including with an undeclared police station in New York City. And here in Canada, you know, there are also similar reports of these secret Chinese police stations, which actually were operating pretty out in the open. It might have been more a case of kind of naive Western awareness of some of these activities. But what do you think about, you know, these arrests?
Oh, I think it's very significant because it sort of creates a blueprint for all the other countries to follow suit. Because when we talk about secret police stations, we call them secret in the sense that the policing aspect is the secret part. The offices themselves are not secret, and they purport to do things like renew driver's licenses, and they probably do that. But they are also policing the behavior of Chinese abroad in other countries. And I was thinking about this the other day, you know, as a student of Chinese history, the Chinese know all about this because they suffered extraterritoriality in all the treaty ports that they lost after the Opium Wars. So, for instance, Shanghai had the French concession. They had the international settlement. And in these places, the foreign countries had their own courts, their own police, their own jurisdiction. So the Chinese know quite well what this is all about. So they probably think they can get away with it.
Yeah.
And so I think the arrests by the U.S., which was quite splashy, is probably shocking them, and it's laying out a roadmap for everybody else to deal with it.
Well, why do you think they can get away with it? Because I try to get at maybe the underpinnings of it. Perhaps they think they're going after people of Chinese descent for the most part, the intimidation. And there's this idea that if you're at all, you know, drop of blood Chinese, you're Chinese, and we have the right to control you, even if you're Canadian, if you're living in the U.S., protection of the U.S. Can you talk a bit about why?
This goes back a century or more, this attitude, and I experienced this myself as a 19-year-old going to China in the Cultural Revolution, when they treat me differently, when they gave me a visa and they didn't give my McGill white classmate a visa. So this idea that if you're ethnic Chinese or you have any Chinese blood, I know that in my period in China, they modified. They used to call me a Hua Qiao, which means, you know, overseas. And then there was Wai Yi Huaren, an ethnic Chinese with a foreign citizenship. And then eventually, you know, as a reporter, when I was a journalist there, I was just a foreigner. So they have this learning curve about people of ethnic Chinese background. But of course, many of the Chinese that they're trying to police are Chinese born. And so they're this interesting status. They think, you know, you're just as pathetic as the rest of us stuck here on the mainland. Why should you have any privileges? Why should you have any freedoms or specialty? So it's all tied up in a lot of this psychological stuff, which had a lot of basis in the categorization of degrees of foreignness for the Chinese. And so what we see with these Chinese police stations is just a natural outcome of the attitude the Chinese authorities have to people who are ethnic Chinese. They think they own you.
Yeah, but in addition, a lot of these people are arrested for intimidating the diaspora. A lot of it is people who are, you know, pro democracy in China, activists and things like that, people who are outspoken about Hong Kong or Xinjiang.
Right.
Yeah. So for people who haven't been following the news in Canada, like we say, internationally, China tries to exert this influence, both with like carrots and sticks, like trying to be a friend to certain people of influence, you know, the United Front Work Department trying to co-opt certain elites, maybe called elite capture and things like that. And then there's also the stick side, which is intimidation, harassment, threatening, using people's family, friends, businesses in China as leverage. But this international conversation has kind of hit Canada, perhaps belatedly, despite all these warnings and reporting over the decades. Can you give our listeners a bit of a summary of what Canada is facing right now with the foreign influence issue?
Global television and the Globe and Mail are at least two news organizations that started reporting recently that the Chinese government interfered in Canadian elections at the federal level, and I think maybe at other levels too. And they were supporting, now we're going to get in the weeds, they were supporting Liberal candidates. There's the two main parties are the Liberals and the Conservatives, with another party, the NDP, usually third place, not always. The Conservatives are a much harder line on China than the Liberals. And so the Chinese didn't want the Conservatives to get in. But what is so interesting is they also wanted the Liberals to be a minority government, mm-hmm. not to have a majority. And I thought that was fascinating.
They like people
fighting. They like people fighting, and they like mm-hmm. their enemies weak. So they didn't want a conservative because they were overtly – they're much tougher on China, but they also didn't want a mm-hmm. majority liberal. And so they were funding people. They would find key races with ethnic Chinese candidates and with a lot of Chinese voters mm-hmm. in the neighborhood, and they would put the money there. That's what these stories have alleged.
And they're based on – basically secret spy documents and intelligence.
Yeah, unnamed intelligence sources, right? We don't know the names of their sources because they mm-hmm. can't speak on the record. And they're getting sued. I think Global's getting sued.
So one of the named MPs is saying that he's looking into legal action. I don't think they've served papers yet, but...
One of them filed a notice.
Yeah, I found a notice. Notice of legal.
Because there's a deadline. He has to.
Yeah, so it's become kind of a media story. Like in a place like Canada, which mm-hmm. is very different from the U.S., where we don't have foreign influence laws, and it's what we have is very patchy and hard for police to act on. I think that kind of explains why in the U.S. we're seeing arrests and people charged, and in Canada we're seeing whistleblowers among spies, uh-huh. agents in Canada, turning to the media uh-huh. to draw attention to these issues.
And just in the defense of the media, when you get sued for libel, there's many stages. So only the first initial stage, mm-hmm. one of the people has filed paperwork for the first stage. But the media has a different responsibility than a private citizen. So truth is always a defense. Mm-hmm. For media. And another defense for journalists is that they are allowed to report allegations as long as the sources are reliable and as long as the journalist mm-hmm. tries to report both sides. So I think everyone would agree that the issue is very important. It's in the public interest. And if the sources mm-hmm. are intelligent sources, then the journalist has done what the journalist is supposed to do. So I don't see this mm-hmm. talked about much, but you know, but it's true, Joanna, as you say, our libel laws are much weaker here than in the United States.
Yeah, not just libel, but also we don't have foreign influence.
Yeah, we don't. Right.
We don't have a suite of laws dealing with
that. Right. So, and that's why the U.S., they arrested these people.
Mm-hmm. We see it, you know, more out in the open, but then that's debatable because the Justice Department since shut down its China initiative to try to specifically prosecute cases like academics working with Chinese foreign entities, because there was accusation that a lot of these prosecutions weren't leading anywhere, but that people being named harmed their reputations.
Yeah, well, this is the other side, right?
Yeah,
this is what we should talk about also, mm-hmm. about the racism, about the fueling of anti-Asian hate. I mean, these are unintended consequences, or perhaps intended, but I would assume unintended consequences of trying mm-hmm. to defend Canada against foreign interference, mm-hmm. you know, because of our... the makeup of our country, because we are a country made up of many, many people from other countries. We have a really different situation here when we have people running for office from whose origins come from a totalitarian dictatorship.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. You know, we've met like in person, luckily, like on several occasions, but I still want to just like talk to you all day.
Yeah, and you're just doing such great work. I don't know how you do it all. I don't know how you do your work and then all this other stuff on the side and, you know.
Oh, well, for New Voices, it's a, it's a labor of love.
And congratulations on all the prizes you won recently.
I just one prize.
Only one, but your book is doing really well too. It's just great. Oh, cool. Oh, I thought you won at least two. Okay, just one.
So we end our podcast with two recommendations.
Okay, so I'll start with the serious book. And it's called The Gates of Europe, and it's a history of Ukraine by Serhii Pokhi. And he's a Harvard professor who's written a history of Ukraine because I'm interested in the war. And I want to understand about the invasion of by Russia, and it helps me understand China and Taiwan, right? China's really interested in Ukraine because of these examples it's going to set for Taiwan. So that's my serious book. It's hard going, and I read it in chunks, and then I have a discussion with a friend. It's not a book club. It's one friend. We read it together, then we go over it. And then my fun book is called The Cello Suites. And it's the story of Bach and Pablo Casals and the search for Bach's 6 cello suites. Why am I reading this? Because one of the things I just started doing in the past 5 months is I'm starting to play the cello. And I've already play the flute, and it's completely different. I just wanted to learn the cello because I have my son's old cello lying around, and I thought, what a waste. But it's very different. It's very difficult. And I told my cello teacher, oh, this is not music. This is like learning. I feel like I'm learning to fly a plane. Everything, you know, the angle, your hand on the bow, the fingering. Oh, my God. But so that's why. So I'm having fun.
Yeah, it seems very difficult.
Yeah. I just went to Switzerland to do a workshop. We played Beethoven's 5th Symphony. I played flute. Don't worry, not my cello. I can barely play anything. And I belong to a bunch of music groups here in Toronto. I belong to flute choir and two concert bands. And I have a trio. Yeah, it's really fun. Amazing.
Okay, so my two book recommendations. The serious one is a book by my good friend Bethany Allen Ibrahimian. I may have messed up her name, but the book is Beijing Rules, and it's very relevant to what we were talking about today, Jen. It's an expose that reveals how China has learned to kind of master and wield capitalism.
Oh, yes, I've heard of this.
Yeah, in its own authoritarian form to help with its goals to, you know, global dominance and power.
Is it a new book?
Yeah, it's coming out in August, but I'm actually reading it because I get a little advanced preview.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm kind of recommending it in advance, and you can pre-order it, and it's out in August. And my fun book, it's a good book. It's called Fleshman is in Trouble. It's about this man in his 40s, a doctor who is recently divorced, and he's discovering that New York is this amazing place where all these women want to sleep with him.
Yeah, in his dreams.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's comedic.
Let me guess, the author is a man?
The author is actually a woman. And then it kind of, it's interesting because it, after a while, you realize he's not a very reliable narrator. which in a way, it's not like making fun of him, but it's kind of all kind of funny and satirical.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, thank you, Jen, for, again, being with us.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for this. It's so much fun to talk to you.
Yeah, it's so great to talk. I'm glad we got to catch up over the podcast. You've been listening to New Voices Podcast with me, Joanna Chu. This episode was produced by Saga Rengmar, edited by Megan Cattell. The intro and outro music is by April Ju. Follow us on Twitter at New Voices, on Instagram, newvoices_network. We're also on Facebook. And thank you for supporting our activities via Patreon. Patrons are invited to play an active role in the community, and you also get exclusive podcast content. More information is available on patreon.com/newvoices. Thank you. Until next time.